All right, good morning. 7:41 here on the Mighty 690. And it is time for our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And starting us out, we have Adavin Strongs. How are you doing, ma'am?
Good morning. Doing good.
Good, good deal. No, it's pretty, you know, not too bad of a morning. It's going to be colder tomorrow.
So. I know. It's definitely going to get colder tomorrow. But today, I think it's supposed to get into the 50s. Should be pretty nice. One last day of kind of nice weather.
Yep. And then, we fall off a cliff. But hey, it's February, so.
Exactly. We really can't complain.
No, we really can't. So, hey, you do have some upcoming programs to tell us about.
Yeah, we have quite a few upcoming programs, as we always do this time of year. So today there are two programs on radon safety. One is in Independence and one is in Parsons. And I believe those are both kind of mid-morning afternoon programs. But if you would like more information on those, you can call our office at 620-331-2690.
Yeah, I've even have the flyer here. We've got Independence, noon. 410 Peter Pan Road, and then Parsons at 530 at 25092 Ness Road.
Okay, so, great.
Yeah,
thank
it's gonna
you.
Be great. And then Iola tomorrow
yes,
at noon.
Yes, I didn't have the Iola one on this list. Thank you.
You're welcome. I was going to talk about it, so you beat me to the punch.
Yeah, and we also have radon test kits available for sale at our offices.
Oh, great.
If anyone's wanting to get one of those. And then tomorrow night at 5:30, we have our prepping for a recession program, which of course is a program. We're calling it prepping for recession because it will be all about farm cash flows. And then a little bit, I believe, on price outlooks for fertilizer, herbicide, fuel, all those big input costs for farmers. This one is free to attend. Dinner's going to be provided. If you're getting off work and can't make it there quite by 5:30, you're more than welcome to come in a little bit later and join the program. And it will be at the Research Center there on the corner of Highway 400 and Ness Road. And then coming up on Tuesday, the 21st, is the OCAN Cattle Conference in Bartlesville. That one will start at 11 with lunch. It's also free to attend. And they will have Dr. Stein from Oklahoma State University talking about cattle reproduction, and Dr. Perjura from the Southeast Research Center talking about soil fertility, pasture health, and then how those two kind of tie together with the quality of hay or pasture that you have related to reproduction of your cows and having that calf crop this year and next year. And also on the 21st is the Soil Health Conference. That one will be in Parsons, and I believe that one is from 9 to 2 o'clock. They'll also be feeding you lunch at that one as well. So we have two different options that day. And then coming up on March 2nd, I will have a sheep and goat marketing workshop. JJ Jones, who's an ag economic specialist with Oklahoma State University, he will be the guest speaker talking about the market outlook for this year for goats and lambs, and then also how to develop a marketing plan. So for sheep and goats, the price for them at auction is largely influenced on holidays such as Easter, Christmas, and then also other ethnic holidays. And those ethnic holidays, what day they fall on changes a little bit each year. So if a producer wants to, kind of timing out when those lambs and kids are ready to go to auction or already to be processed for meat, that can have a pretty significant influence on the price. And for especially newer producers, it might take a while to figure out how to plan that all out. So this will be a really good workshop for new producers and also experienced producers. For the past several years, JJ has been giving a really good economic outlook every year, just so producers have an idea of what to expect as far as prices and getting an idea of when those highs and lows in the market will be.
Sure, and I know there are also some producers specifically around college towns who will kind of cater to a lot of the like foreign exchange students and students from other countries, especially I'm thinking in the form of like halal meat for goats and everything, because that's actually a decent sized, you know, kind of niche market.
Yeah, it is. It's a good sized market, and especially if producers are a little bit closer to a city, whether it's Tulsa, Joplin, Wichita, or Kansas City, you know, just those bigger urban areas, you get a larger mix of people from different backgrounds and countries where goat meat was a larger part of their diet, and or lamb. So then you can get into kind of the decision process of a producer, whether you want to sell them direct off your property or if you want to just take them, you know, all kind of at once to the sale barn and run them through the sale and sell them that way. So those are different options to definitely weigh out or to decide if you want to take part to the sale barn, sell part of them directly off your property.
Gotcha. And it's a little bit more apples and oranges, but I mean, there are some producers out there doing the actual goat milk and cheese operation too.
Yes. Yeah. So that's kind of a whole nother segment, but I'm glad you brought it up because meat goats have gotten really popular in the last several years, but dairy goats have been around for a while. And like you mentioned, those producers, of course, they're raising goats for the milk production. So they're milking them and using that milk, you know, just to drink the whole milk or to make cheese and soaps, lotions, butter. There's a whole selection of things that can be made out of goat's milk. And then they can market those products as well. And then for those producers, also sell the kids every year too.
I'm just curious, are there automatic milkers out there for goats, or is it more hand milking on this, or do you have any idea on that?
Yeah, so I actually started out in 4-H raising dairy goats and worked on a goat dairy for a little while in college. So there are milk machines made for goats that work just like cattle.
Okay.
So you can have the smaller ones that milk one or two goats at a time, which if someone just had a few goats at their house, that would be what they used. Or for goat dairies, they have the big milk parlor setups, just like they do for dairy cattle, just on a smaller scale to fit the goats.
Yeah, that's really cool. Good deal. Well, today you said you wanted to just kind of speaking of goats and sheep and herded animals and that sort of thing. Talking a little about livestock guardians and dogs.
Yeah. So to kind of tie in talking about goats and sheep, I thought I'd talk a little bit today about livestock guardians. Because for goats and sheep, unfortunately, one of the biggest losses producers take is from predators. So coyotes, of course, are a really common one. Also, just stray or neighborhood dogs are as well. So one way to reduce that death loss and hopefully help prevent it entirely is people use livestock guardians. So livestock guardians can be most commonly and usually most effectively are livestock guardian dogs, but they can also use sometimes llamas or donkeys people use as well. Llamas, they definitely have an alert system. So if you're around, you can usually hear they have an alert whistle and that will kind of notify you that something's out there that's caught their attention. The only downside to llamas is they don't have a lot of defense mechanisms more so than the goats or sheep do. They can kind of kick and they can alert you, but of course they can't fight back as effectively as a livestock guardian dog. People also use donkeys. They tend to be a little bit more aggressive than llamas and can fight back a little bit more. You just kind of want to be careful with the donkeys that you get, because some can also tend to be more aggressive towards the goats and sheep, sure. Especially when it comes to feed time and not wanting to share the food. So the big thing with getting a livestock guardian of any kind is getting one that will fit in with your herd well, and especially if you can find an experienced livestock guardian or buy one that's been raised around sheep and goats, that's really the best way to go. And then with the livestock guardian dogs specifically, so livestock guardian dogs aren't just, you know, any dog that you put out with your sheep and goats, because that could end very badly. But there are specific breeds of dogs known as livestock guardian dog breeds that are similar. These breeds have been developed just to protect livestock, similarly to how border collies have been bred to herd livestock. These dogs have been the breeds have been developed to protect livestock. So, you know, a common breed is the Great Pyrenees, which are the really big, white, fluffy dogs. But there's also Anatolians, and there's a whole variety of breeds out there. If you're interested, definitely look those up. A lot of the breeds are hard to pronounce the name of, so I'm not even gonna try.
Now, so that's a good point, that, you know, people think a sheepdog or whatever, they automatically go to, you know, the collie, border collie, whatever. I mean, even a Shetland sheepdog, kind of. You know, at least nip your heels. But there is going to be a difference between those actual guardians versus the herding dogs. Are there any that do both herding and the guardians, or are they really kind of two separate?
They're really kind of two separate deals, because of course those herding dogs, they're bred to gather up the sheep, for example, and bring them in. So they're a great asset, especially if you have a bigger herd, for helping you gather all those sheep in if you're going to work them or move them to a different pasture. But they're bred to, you know, move those animals where you want to move them.
Yeah. And so I just imagine that having a herding dog in there all the time and just be wanting to move them around.
Right.
And they just wear them out.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It would be trying to do its job of moving them around. Where those livestock guardian dogs, they've been bred to protect those animals. So they really won't move them unless, you know, they kind of just like circle around them, protecting them from a predator. But one thing that I thought was interesting about livestock guardian dog breeds is that each breed has kind of been bred to protect the herd in a different way. So the Great Pyrenees, they've been bred more to protect the perimeter of the flock. So they'll hang out with the sheep and goats, but they'll also walk around the perimeter of the pasture. One downside to them being more protecting the perimeter of the flock is they're also more prone to wander. So if you're on a smaller property, maybe you have neighbors nearby or by a busy street, that's one thing to keep under consideration, where other breeds are bred to stay with the herd. So they'll stay right with those goats and sheep. And for example, if a coyote were to come in, they'll either, you know, fight the coyote, or they'll chase it off as far as they have decided it's no longer a threat. And then they'll go back to their herd. And then other breeds are bred to, they'll actually chase that coyote or whatever it is down and until it's no longer a threat. So they'll actually leave the herd to go chase it down. So in Wyoming and Montana, where sheep producers are having a really hard time with the wolves, they've actually started using, you know, three different types of dogs. And usually they have at least two of each type, because up in Wyoming and Montana, they run really big herds of sheep, hundreds to even thousands. So they have, you know, pairs of dogs, some even kind of have their own little pack of livestock guardian dogs. So they'll have ones that, you know, will stay with the herd at all times. They'll have those other breeds like Great Pyrenees that protect the perimeter. And then they'll have the ones that will go and chase the threat down. So it really gets to be pretty cool how those dogs can work together to take care of their herd and do their job. And there's also, you can also get different crosses of livestock guardian breeds as well.
Is there any rule of thumb on the ratio of livestock guardians to the actual size of the herd?
No, not really. But you do, you know, you don't want to get too many dogs. You do kind of keep it at a ratio. There's not an exact rule of thumb, but usually it's more by like pasture size. They'll have like, you know, if it's a herd of about 25, usually they'll have one dog in that pasture. Now the kind of the exception is if you're getting a livestock guardian dog, it's recommended you get one that's been raised around sheep and goats, and people that raise sheep and goats, sometimes they'll also raise livestock guardian dogs.
Sure.
Because like any dog breed, you know, some have better instincts than others, because just because it's that breed doesn't mean that, you know, it will know what to do or be a good fit and you won't have any problems with it, you know, wanting to play with the sheep and goats or chase them or kind of that natural puppy behavior.
Yep.
So getting one that's been raised around them is really your best bet to having a successful one.
Good deal.
And then if you can pair like a younger one with an older one to train them, that works out good as well.
Awesome. Well, we got a lot more coming up next hour here on the Mighty 690, our chat with K-State Research and Extension coming up here on KGGF. All right, coming up on 8:10 here on the Mighty 690, our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District continues, and we are joined now by Jesse Gilmore. How are you doing, Jesse?
Pretty good. Had a good, nice, warm Valentine's Day.
Hey, that's great. I mean, it really was, and it wasn't as windy here as what I was quite expecting. I mean, I know we did get a few gusts up into like the 50-mile-an-hour range or so, but really wasn't too bad in town, at least. You know, outside of town, it's usually a different story.
Yeah, in Girard, it was pretty windy, yeah. And that made it kind of hard to prune the rose bushes outside of the office there.
Is that what you were getting for your bouquet? For
No, it didn't have roses on it right now, and actually, that's why, ideally, you prune your rose bushes around Valentine's Day before they start putting out new growth in the spring. And that's a nice little mnemonic, you know, roses pruned on Valentine's Day and potatoes dug on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh.
So you've got two different things associated with those holidays that make it really easy to remember
that
the
timing.
That
is pretty easy to remember.
But yeah, since it was Valentine's Day, I thought today we'd talk a little bit about rose bushes.
Great.
And if we have some time, bouquet management to keep your flowers and your Valentine's Day bouquets alive as long
as
possible.
Sure, absolutely.
So rose bushes, you have really two different categories of rose bushes. The first is species roses, which are not hybrids. Species roses are typically going to bloom only once during the year and then potentially put out rose hips, which are the fruits that roses create once their flowers are pollinated. Species roses are kind of falling out of favor a little bit because they are not as disease resistant as hybrid roses are, and especially in places like southeast Kansas, where we get a lot of spring rain, that can lead to problems like powdery mildew. When I worked at a landscaping company up in Kansas City, powdery mildew was a big problem. We had to use a lot of copper fungicide to try and kill that off.
So that's kind of like an heirloom. You would kind of call it an heirloom.
Yeah, yeah. That is really the best way to describe it.
Okay.
There's a lot of different groups of single species roses, and they're all going to have slightly different management based on where in the world they originate from, like European roses or North American roses, for example, the vast majority of what you're going to be able to find in garden centers are hybrid roses. And a lot of times you'll see these labeled as tea roses. These are roses that are crosses of multiple different species. And these have much better disease resistance. So in almost any case, I would recommend tea roses or hybrid roses for your landscape because of the heavy rains and the more wet conditions that we end up with. These are going to bloom multiple times during the year and put out very few, if any, rose hips. And so deadheading during the growing season is very important in order to encourage multiple blooms during the year. Deadheading is just the act of cutting off spent flower blooms, and the shrub will put out new flowers during the year. If you have rose hips, you have the option, if you do have a species that has rose hips, you have the option of cutting those off or leaving them on. Personally, I think that rose hips have a lot of visual flair to them. Not obviously not the same flair as the blooms themselves, but they are interesting in their own right. Rose hips are also edible and most often used in rose hip tea. So you can use the fruits in tea, or you can eat the fruits. Just make sure that you remove the seeds before consuming the rose hips. I had the opportunity to eat a rose hip once, and I did not realize that the seeds were as crunchy as they were. And I almost chipped a tooth. So the seeds are pretty substantial.
And do you, for the tea, do you dry those out?
Yes, you would, yeah. But rose hips in general are one of the biggest sources of vitamin C per weight. So it is... You have some reasons to get species roses if you want those rose hips. Just keep in mind that disease management is going to be more important.
Gotcha.
And I mentioned powdery mildew. One disease that we saw making the rounds quite a lot when I worked for that landscaping company is a virus called rose rosette. And this is a virus that is usually spread by soil-borne mites, and it is present in the soil. So if you have rose rosette on a rose bush right now, removing that rose bush and planting a new one is not going to eliminate the disease, or the new rose bush will catch the disease. It can also be spread on pruning equipment, so it is very important to understand the symptoms of that disease if you have a rose bush that seems to be struggling, so that you don't accidentally spread it to other rose bushes that you might have that are healthy. The symptoms of rose rosette are really excess thorniness on the tips of new growth. These are going to be smaller and very insubstantial. When you think of rose thorns, you think of them as, you know, thick, fleshy thorns. These thorns are going to be very thin to the point where you could run your finger along the stem without catching it on anything. Okay. You also would see new red growth that never greens up in diseased shrubs. And you'd also see witch's brooming, which will lead to the eventual decline and death of the shrub. There's also no cure for this virus, so it's very important to keep your eyes out for that. I would say that it's mostly up in the Kansas City area. I have not had anyone call me about their rose bush and seen the disease down here yet. But it is something to keep in mind, because you want to make sure, especially if you're getting a new rose bush from a garden center, that you aren't accidentally bringing home one that has already been infected.
How is it actually spread, I guess?
Through the mites.
Okay, and
When it's spread from shrub to shrub, usually that's going to be because of unsanitized pruning equipment. You prune a diseased shrub, the virus ends up on the blade of your pruner, and then you go and prune an undiseased shrub.
I would have never have thought to clean that. That's just wild.
Yeah, and you can clean that with, you know, rubbing alcohol. That'll sanitize your equipment just fine. Or bleach, but I would not recommend pouring bleach over other types of plants if you're out in the garden. Rubbing alcohol is just simpler and probably cheaper to sanitize with, too. Not a ton of diseases are spread like that. Dutch elm disease, if you prune a diseased elm tree and then go to a healthy elm tree, that is one. Usually funguses are the ones that are spread the most, but viruses can be as well. Viruses don't make up a ton of the disease, like the aggregate of plant diseases. Fungi are going to account for about 90%, then bacteria, and then viruses, and then nematodes. So viruses are not very common at all, but when they hit, they can be pretty devastating. So that is one disease to look out for. Because now is the time that you should be pruning your roses, you want to prune out anything that's dead, first of all. Sometimes the shape of the rose bush will be more important than making sure everything that is dead gets out of the rose bush.
So what is a good shape? What do we want?
Really, it kind of depends on where it is in your garden.
Okay.
For example, at the Girard office, I kind of let the rose bushes go for a couple of years, and they were starting to grow right into the brick wall that was behind them. So just making sure that they're away from walls, that they are in whatever shape you want, honestly. Could be square, could be... Most people go for the rounded sphere.
But some people, I mean, if they, especially if you're going to make like a kind of formal garden, you know, they kind of like that square hedge almost shape.
Yeah, yeah, that would definitely be one way to do it. And roses do hedge better than most other shrubs. You just want to make sure that you are not over removing dead or non-productive wood in the shrub to keep that shape. The shape in that case would be more important than the... total pruning. But if you only want new productive flowering growth, you would want to make sure you remove as much of the non-productive wood as possible, and that will leave a much more open shrub, which will reduce the potential for disease, especially if you have a species shrub, because you get more airflow through the center of the shrub. And so when the leaves get wet, they dry off faster. The longer that any plant stays wet, the more likely you are going to be to encounter disease because, as I mentioned before, 90% of plant diseases are fungal, and fungal diseases are made worse by wet conditions, always. Yeah, that is kind of the balance of pruning for... whether you want a shapely rosebush or you want a productive rosebush. And it's up to the individual owner which is better.
Now, so, are roses useful for pollinators at all?
They can be. When most roses are going to be some form of red, so pink, magenta, red, that is not as attractive to most of what we consider pollinators. Those are going... bees, wasps, the like, they're going to be attracted more to yellows and blues and purples. So that's not to say that they can't end up on roses, but it is less likely.
Now I'm trying to think, it was either tulips or roses or maybe both that we haven't figured out how to do a blue version of.
Both.
Okay.
That'd be both. Blue flowers aren't very common and shrubs.
Yeah.
They are much more common in herbaceous plants like salvia.
And two, I was thinking about hydrangeas. You know, you can do the whatever. I can't remember what you put on them to make them change to blue.
It's a combination of soil fertility and soil pH. Uh-huh. So you need to manage both of them during the year for hydrangeas.
Sure.
But yeah, soil management is going to be pretty much the same across every type of rose you can buy, whether that's a species rose or a hybrid rose. But yeah, after you prune out the dead, you would want to prune back live growth to the nearest bud that is in the shape that you want.
Okay.
Like with most other plants, you don't really want to take off more than a third of its live growth. You will be able to tell what's live on a rose bush compared to what is non-productive based on color, mostly. The productive growth is still going to look greenish-red during the winter, and the dead non-productive growth is going to look gray.
Okay.
So you might encounter... live growth down near the base that becomes gray near the end, that is a frost burned section of live growth. Basically, the plant put out new growth near the end of the growing season in the fall that was not alive enough, essentially, when we got a cold snap. and so the tips would be burned. You can cut that live growth back to the nearest bud that is in the part that is still red and green, and it will continue pushing out new growth.
Gotcha.
But that part, that frost-tipped part, is not going to be productive growth, so you would want to cut that out.
Anything on fertilization, or is that kind of down the line as we get closer to the growing season, I guess, for roses?
So, yeah, that is more down the line. It depends on how well you manage your weeds around the base of the shrub. The ones in Girard have a lot of henbit growing around them right now, and so if we fertilized that, the henbit would use the fertilizer. The roses, because they're not actively growing, would not. So we'd basically just be fertilizing the weeds. And, you know, henbit, you can use that in a tea too, so yeah. For foragers, that might be worth trying. But no, it's definitely worth getting a soil test right now to see what you need to fertilize with, and giving yourself a little bit of time to go out and get that fertilizer, and then applying it to the rose bush as we start seeing live growth and start seeing greening up.
Good deal. All
and right. Yeah, you can get a soil sample
at
any extension office. That's true for Arkansas, that's true for Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas. The process is going to be a little bit different depending on which extension service you're using. The cost is also going to be a little bit different, but most soil tests are going to be able to tell you, at least at ours, phosphorus and potassium and soil pH. We also offer a package that includes nitrogen and organic matter, and especially if you compost, organic matter can be very important. But you would just bring a soil sample in, we would ship it to the lab on campus, I get the results back, or David gets the results back, depending on what you're trying to grow or do with the soil, and then we make recommendations on how much fertilizer you need to get it up, to get your soil up to where it needs to be. And that way you're not spending extra money on fertilizer that you don't need, and you're also applying it in the proper way so that you don't experience losses. Because depending on the fertilizer that you apply or when you apply it, if you apply it before a huge rainstorm, for example, your fertilizer that is sitting on top of the soil can be taken away from where you want it and put somewhere else. And that can lead to problems in waterways. If it's carried to a river or a pond, you can lead to excessive algae growth that can cause problems.
All sorts of weird stuff starts happening there.
So. Yep. As far as other fertilizers go. Oh, I get asked a lot about fertilizer sources. Garden centers are a good place to start looking, but a better place that, in my experience, will have higher grade fertilizers is local co-ops. So if you live near a co-op, give them a call and see what fertilizers they have available. That way, you don't need to apply as much fertilizer. So
yeah, is there a number we're looking for?
So when you have a fertilizer, you have a three-number analysis. That's going to be nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium in that order. The higher-grade fertilizers like urea, which is 4600, so half, almost half, of what you apply is pure nitrogen, essentially, or nitrogen that will end up in the plant in some way. Lower grade fertilizers like 10-10-10, yeah, that's the standard for application for yards and gardens. Only 10% of what you're applying is nitrogen, phosphorus, or potassium. And there's a lot of reasons for that. In some cases, it can be more beneficial to apply lower grade fertilizers because with urea in particular, you have to be careful that you're not applying it directly to plants because it can lead to scorch. Because it is a higher concentration and because of the specific form in which urea is has the nitrogen. Urea, I recommend urea a lot for gardeners because it acidifies the soil in addition to providing nitrogen. pH is usually pretty high when it comes to our soils, and for reasons that I probably don't have time to get into right now. But by applying urea, you get that kind of double benefit of acidifying the soil, getting the pH down to a more optimum range for vegetables or for shrubs and trees, and getting the nitrogen that plants need for growth. Because nitrogen is pretty much the limiting factor when it comes to explosive growth of roses, of trees, of vegetables, or just of ornamentals.
Gotcha.
So the co-op is going to have those higher analysis fertilizers, urea, DAP or diammonium phosphate, which is 18460. So you get about half of your concentration in that fertilizer will be phosphorus, and then potash, which is 60% potassium. So those are the three, if you are really deficient in one or more of those nutrients, that I will typically recommend. And usually you're not going to be able to find those in most garden centers. It's worth trying, but co-ops are going to be the most likely place to find those.
So get that soil test so that you get your baseline, then you can figure out what you need to do.
Yep. And for my soil recommendations, at least, I'll recommend specific fertilizers that would be the best balance of cheapest and most effective for what you're needing.
Good deal. Well, on another topic, of course, we do have Valentine's Day was yesterday. People might have some bouquets and that sort of thing. What do they need to do with those to keep them going?
Yeah, so obviously bouquets aren't going to last forever. They're going to die at some point, but you do want to keep them alive as long as possible. And that will mostly include management of the cut end of the stem. So when stems are first cut, they are open. They allow for the translocation of water up into the bloom, but the longer that it sits in the water, the more likely it will be that that cut ends up plugged and you will need to recut. When you recut, you want to make sure that you do it underwater so that the change in pressure, basically the pressure from the atmosphere, pushes the water down and up into the tissue, which then carries it up into the bloom.
Okay.
So cut it underwater. Make sure you're using a sharp blade. Could be a razor blade, could be scissors. You don't want to pinch the tissue shut because that's doing the exact opposite of what you're hoping for. The other thing that some people ask is whether or not they should fertilize bouquets. Mm-hmm. If you're given fertilizer,
the little packet.
Yeah, if you're given fertilizer from the flower shop that provides the bouquet, yes, you will want to do that. And sometimes that can prolong the life of the flower. Usually, if you aren't provided fertilizer, it's not really worth going out and getting fertilizer for the bouquet.
Sure.
The last thing you need to think about when it comes to bouquet management is not putting them near a heat source. Well, actually, there's two more things. Not putting it near a heat source that would cause the flower to wither faster. And also... Okay, sorry, three things. Not putting it near a heat source. Not putting it near an ethylene source. So this is only going to matter if you are keeping your bouquet in the kitchen. Ethylene is a gas that is produced from certain types of fruits, usually citrus and apples. Hmm. And this is a gas that speeds up a plant's biological clock. So if a plant is getting exposed to ethylene, they're going to wither faster. They're going to really just degrade more quickly. So you want to make sure you're not storing your bouquet next to oranges, lemons, things like that. Again, only really important if you're keeping the bouquet in the kitchen. The last is to keep an eye on the water, and if it gets cloudy, to replace it. I do not remember off the top of my head the reason why water would get cloudy in vases with bouquets, but replacing that
water... We've seen it happen.
Replacing that water will keep your flowers alive longer.
That's fascinating. I mean, I learned just so much right there. I mean, who knew? So, granted, I don't know a lot about flowers, but I think I picked up a few things that I've seen maybe done wrong for a while, so keep them going longer. So, that's great. And about fruits putting off gases, who knew?
Yep.
This is wild. So, good deal. Well, Jesse, Davin, Davin, you want to maybe go over just real quick a couple of those upcoming classes and such we have, just for maybe people who are just tuning in?
Yeah, so the ones that we have coming up the soonest are, of course, the radon one today. Mm-hmm. That one is at noon in Independence and at 5 in Parsons. And then we have our prepping for recession workshop tomorrow evening at 5:30 in Parsons. Again, this will be going over cash flows and some price predictions for farming. A lot of really good information. Dinner is included in that one. And then next Tuesday, we have the OCAN Cattle Conference in Bartlesville starting at 11, and then the Soil Health Workshop in Parsons starting at 9, and lunch will be provided with both of those.
Okay, well, very good. And Jesse and David, if folks have any questions on really anything we've talked about, be it, sheep and goat management or, all our rose topics and everything, how can they get a hold of y'all?
Of course, they can call any one of our extension offices, and they can put you in touch with us. The number to the Independence office is 620-331-2690.
And for Gerard, it's 620-724-8233.
Awesome. Well, very good, both of you. It's always great to have you on, and I look forward to chatting again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Sounds good.
All right. And we'll be back here with an early bird edition of Open Line. And we also do have Candy Westbrook of the Coffeyville Chamber of Commerce coming in shortly here at 9:10 on the Mighty 690 as we continue throughout a Wednesday.